Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I'm going to be talking about Aesthetics, Mozart, and the Pathway of Beauty. And where does that come from? Well, in his inaugural homily of 2005, amazing to think that's now 20 years ago, Pope Benedict XVI renewed his call for the pathway of beauty, the Via Pulchritudinis. It is this call. There is nothing more beautiful than to know Christ, than to speak to others of our friendship with him, that also launched the Pontifical Council of Cultures document the following year, 2006. Responding to the prevailing religious indifference, materialism, and unbelief in early 21st century culture, and to a society in which truth itself and ethics in particular are under grave threat, whether, it states, instrumentalized by ideologies, relativized so that objective truth becomes hard to discern, or flattened so that the good is horizontalized into a merely social act, Pope Benedict XVI and the Council proposed the pathway of beauty, the Via Pulchritudinis, as a pathway of evangelization of cultures and a crucial dialogue with non-believers leading to Christ, the way, the truth, and the life. An accomplished amateur pianist as well as professional theologian, for Pope Benedict XVI himself, music appears to have been a particularly privileged pathway of beauty. Speaking in 2015, he asked, "What in reality is music? From where does it come and to what does it tend?" And he looked at this anthropologically and he said, look, the first source is the experience of being seized by love, which opens up a new dimension of being, a greatness of breadth and breadth of reality, impelling expression through poetry, song, and music, and we can see that across different cultures. The second source is the experience of sadness, of suffering, being touched by death, by pain, by the abysses of existing. And again, this seems to elicit in us, in human beings, a dimension of reality that cannot be expressed through words alone. And the third, he says, is an encounter with the divine, which, like the experiences of love and death, is part of what it is to be human and which demands new ways of expression. And for Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, he said that also in those two areas, love and death, the divine mystery touches us. And in this sense, it is being touched by God that on the whole constitutes the origin of music. So in this talk, I've sort of structured in two parts really, but I want to start by reflecting a little bit more together on this pathway of beauty, the Via Pulchritudinis, and then in its light turn to the music of one preeminent Christian composer, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Okay, so the pathway of beauty. Better start with the TI with St. Thomas Aquinas. Father Andrew is saying, are you going to be bringing St. Thomas Aquinas? So here we go. In Thomas Aquinas's pithy formulation, beauty is that which, when seen, brings delight. Id quod visum placet. But here, being seen, visum, refers generically to perception. So we can also say being heard or being understood, such that a piece of music or a mathematical proof, as much as a painting, can give delight. What is key, though, in this classical understanding of beauty, is that it is the perception itself which causes delight, which pleases, placet, and not what might or might not follow on from it. So the perception of beauty and the attraction to beauty on this view is not the same as the desire for pleasure. So I don't know whether you have Fisher and Donaldson's in Edinburgh, whether that's just in St. Andrews. So maybe none of you have tasted a fudge donut. Has anyone tasted a Fisher and Donaldson fudge donut? Ah, there we go. Has anyone tasted cheesecake? Cheesecake, yes. Ice cream? Yeah, you do have ice cream in Edinburgh. I mean, you're so provincial over here. I mean, you don't have fudge donuts, but, you know, we have fudge donuts. Basically, it's just a donut full of fudge. But I'll talk about sliced cheesecake instead, slices of cheesecake, because obviously you have that in strawberry ice cream. But I desire strawberry ice cream, right? Because when eaten, I know that it will give me pleasure. Right, and even thinking about strawberry ice cream, Father Andrew again was very disappointed because we didn't have time after our very delicious pizza to have ice cream. So all he's doing is he's kind of salivating because he can see this Knickerbocker glory and these kind of extraordinary banana splits. But you know, in thinking about them, whether we like it or not, so I'm picking on you, we have a physiological reaction, right? We start salivating in expectation of the pleasure those things are going to give us, right? The classical definition of beauty has nothing to do with that. Okay, it's not that kind of thing, because we say that a fudge donut or a bowl of ice cream is not beautiful, right? Beauty is the disinterested one. In St. Augustine's words, it is to be enjoyed, not used. We enjoy something as beautiful, be it a painting, a church, a piece of music, without needing to possess or consume it or derive pleasure from it. The perception of beauty is different in kind, then, to sensual pleasures, the pleasures of food, of wine, of sex. Beauty involves our intellect and our will, and the delight we experience is principally of the heart and mind. And St. Thomas famously outlined, then, three classical conditions of beauty. Three things are required, he said, for beauty. First, integrity or perfection. For things that are lessened are ugly by this very fact. Second, proportion or harmony. And third, clarity or brilliance, splendor. So what does he mean by this? So we naturally like to see something complete, perfect, with integrity or wholeness, whether it's a beautiful flower in full bloom, a beautiful face. You see someone's beautiful, there's a perfect symmetry without physical defaults, such as a missing eye, a squint nose, missing teeth, scarring, etc. Or, as I mentioned before, even a mathematical proof. There's something beautiful about it because everything is clear. There's nothing lacking. Aquinas' second condition is due proportion or harmony. And, you know, we might think here, I was just talking to an architectural historian of a beautiful Romanesque or Gothic cathedral, and the delight, even the wonder we may experience in seeing these buildings. And we might contrast that with, or contrast that perception, again, a classical understanding of beauty, with due proportion, harmony, with the distaste we might feel at the ugliness of some purely utilitarian or even brutalist designs. So St. Thomas's third condition, this is a bit more difficult to understand, I think, is claritas, or clarity, brilliance, and splendor. But it's really important. It's the way in which beauty reveals, shines forth the depth of reality. It's clarity. So even if we might say, like, it's a beautiful day, we don't get that many of those in St. Andrews. Maybe you get a few more in Edinburgh. But if someone said to you, it's a beautiful day in St. Andrews, you'd probably think, the sun's out, there's a blue sky, there's clarity. This is what's being meant, in a sense, by clarity in this sense. Or we might say, you know, when you say beautiful, a diamond's beautiful, it's clear, it's clarity, there's a kind of brilliance. But you might even say, if you think of Michelangelo's David, there's something beautiful about it in the sense of the form that shines through the bronze. There's a clarity of the form that's coming out. Okay, so this is a philosophical recovery. St. Pope John Paul II was someone who really called for this philosophical recovery of beauty as part of a wider recuperation of classical philosophy. And as part of that, then, a recuperation of what's sometimes known as the transcendentals of the true, the good, and the beauty. And they relate to reality, the truth regarding being as knowable, intelligible, of course, as you'd know, a sort of budding Thomist, I hope. The good regarding being as desirable in its aspect of being desirable. But beauty tells forth reality itself in the perfection of its form. Beauty attracts us or captures us with a ray capable of igniting marvel. And, you know, I think some of us maybe had experience. It might be a beautiful piece of music. It might be a beautiful poem. It might be an incredible building. We just find ourselves being taken out of ourselves. We find ourselves being attracted to something. We seem to intuit some kind of form, right? And that is being attracted to beauty. And it leads us always to then discover, well, what is the being behind that beauty? What is the truth which is being brought forth and conveyed to us? And we might say that while a materialist philosophy, plenty of that going around, does not open onto the metaphysical, and while a false understanding of beauty entraps us within the phenomena of a closed world, a true philosophy takes us beyond the phenomena to their foundation, from the visible to the invisible. And a true beauty can similarly act as a hook. It captures us, it attracts us, revealing or at least pointing us towards the depths of reality. The beauty of creation is, for St. Augustine, a confession, inviting us to contemplate beauty in its source, the creator of heaven and earth. Or as C.S. Lewis puts it in Weight of Glory, created beauty provokes in us a longing to be united with, to receive into ourselves, and to enter into that infinite beauty of which all created beauty is but a reflection. Okay, so thus far I've been talking about a natural perception of beauty and how this can lead us to God. For the baptized Christian, however, it is above all the beauty of Christ as model and prototype of Christian holiness which provokes his or her pathway of beauty. And as head of the church, his mystical body, this beauty of Christ is shared in her members and in the holiness of their lives transformed by grace. So again, St. Thomas Aquinas, and here we move to a spiritual beauty. St. Thomas locates spiritual beauty in a man or woman's conduct or actions being well proportioned with respect of the spiritual clarity of reason, and likewise in a celebrated address, the feeling of things, the contemplation of beauty. Again, this is Pope Benedict XVI, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. He reflected, "I have often affirmed my conviction that the true apology of Christian faith, the most convincing demonstration of its truth against every denial, are the saints and the beauty that the faith has generated. Today, for faith to grow, we must lead ourselves and the persons we meet to encounter the saints and to enter into contact with the beautiful." Following the lead of, I'm getting a bit theological. I'm just in a theology department, so I shouldn't sort of be, you know, hammering you with theologians, but some of you may have come across Hans Urs von Balthasar. Following his lead, Ratzinger also claims that Christ, in revealing himself as beauty, fundamentally transformed it from within. Christ is the fairest of the children of men, but he also had no beauty, no majesty to draw our eyes, no grace to make us delight in him. The Greek aesthetic, the classical understanding of beauty, which leads to a contact with the divine, but which remained inexpressible for it, receives a new depth, a new realism in Christ's passion. The one who is the beauty itself let himself be slapped in the face, spat upon, crowned with thorns. Ratzinger invites us to contemplate in Christ's disfigured face the genuine extreme beauty, the beauty of love that goes to the very end. So the contemplation for a Christian of Christ on the cross invites us to be wounded by a beauty and a love that goes beyond anything found in nature or creation, and the kind of classical account of beauty which I started with. And we can see that kind of beauty reflected in the lives of the saints as well. While he said many people perceive Christianity as a submission to commandments made up of prohibitions and limits applied to personal liberty, it's beautiful to be a Christian. The experience lets us grow. The joy of being Christian is beauty. The saint, for Benedict XVI, is the one who's so fascinated by the beauty of God and by his perfect truth that he is progressively transformed by it. For this beauty and this truth, he is ready to renounce everything, even himself. Okay, so that's a bit of aesthetics and a Thomistic perspective. And I've kind of introduced separately two pathways, philosophical and theological, you might say natural and supernatural, of beauty. In turning now to the beauty of the arts, we could speak then of art, which, not informed directly by Christian revelation, nevertheless expresses the beauty of creation with the capacity to evoke the ineffable aspects of the mystery of God, or to provoke interior emotion, arouse astonishment. However, of course, in Christian life, in Christian liturgy and art, these two pathways, like two wings, come together. The Christian artist can take inspiration from the contemplation of Christ in the mystery of the incarnation and the redemption. And more deeply, the Christian artist participates in the beauty of Christ through grace. And this holiness, this grace, may overflow into his or her art. Okay, so that's the pathway of beauty bit. And, well, oh, sorry, that's the aesthetics bit. Now let's come on to dear old Mozart. Can we speak of God speaking through this little man? Right, so I've split this into little bits and I've given you some music. So I thought it'd be awful, you know, to just have a talk on aesthetics, Mozart, and the pathway of beauty, and then just to speak for an hour. It's not even going to be an hour, but there's going to be some beauty and Mozart along the way. So first of all, beloved by God, the miracle of Mozart's musical gift. Mozart, as some of you may know, was baptized John Chrysostom Wolfgang Theophilus Mozart on the feast day of St. John Chrysostom, the 27th of January in 1756. Posthumously, of course, he has also become known by the name Amadeus, the Latin form of Theophilus, which may mean beloved of God or lover of God. And Amadeus, we can say, was indeed beloved of God. From his infancy, Amadeus' father, Leopold, believed that his son's extraordinary musical talent was a special, miraculous gift from God, and that it was his duty as a father, his own Christian vocation, to foster, nurture, and share this miraculous gift with a skeptical world. So this is Leopold in a letter of 1768. He said, "If it is ever to be my duty to convince the world of this miracle, it is now, when people are ridiculing whatever is called a miracle and denying all miracles. That is why they must be convinced." So although Amadeus Mozart was born into a very devout Catholic family and pious, his father Leopold was highly conscious that the elite thinkers of his day were undermining, if not ridiculing, the bedrock of Christian faith. Both Leopold and later his son Amadeus would single out the fashionable views of Voltaire, for example, and Voltaire's withering critique of Catholic religious practice. Leopold explained, "Was it not my great joy and a tremendous victory for me to hear a Voltairean say to me in amazement, 'For once in my life, I have seen a miracle,'" with regard to Mozart. And on Voltaire's death in 1778, Amadeus wrote to his father, "The arch scoundrel Voltaire has finally kicked the bucket." So for Leopold then, Mozart's prodigious gift of music was God's answer to the rationalists and the deists of his day. It was truly a divine gift beyond merely human comprehension, and which nonetheless struck the heart and minds of its listeners. So I'm going to suggest we listen as a brief illustration to the opening of, it's one of my favorite pieces of music, but it's the opening of Mozart's very first string quartet in G major, it's K80, which he wrote on the 15th of March aged just 14. And as you're listening to it, what I just find miraculous about this, I mean, obviously I don't find it literally miraculous, but what I love about it is when you listen to the opening, it sounds perfect and complete. Right? You'll hear the melody in the first violin, and you'll hear a four-part harmony, which you would expect from a string quartet. But then you're listening out of nowhere and seemingly impossibly, a descant, this high note is heard, soaring above the first violin, creating, I think, a moment of sheer wonder. And you can tell me how it's possible, because it seems that we've got four, the whole quartet playing, it's a perfect quartet, and then this note comes out of nowhere. Okay, so I'm going to play it to you. Just to warn you, before you hear it, you're going to be shocked by some adverts for something random, and it could be anything. So we'll just see. Open stocks. Oh my gosh.
And I'm moving onwards and upwards.
Okay, so that's very interesting that, you know, whatever AI thinks that I've got money to invest in stocks, because I really don't. But anyway, that's at least it's not advertising something even worse. Well, it wouldn't be me, actually. It'd be you, wouldn't it? If you've got lots of money just stashed around that it's advertising. Okay, right, okay. Okay, yeah. Okay, right, so here we go. He wrote this age 14. You're going to hear a perfect quartet, wholesome, whatever, and then out of nowhere. So then how does it happen? That's your question. Here we go. Okay, very beautiful. So how does he do it? Did anyone see what he does? You've got a quartet at the beginning. What happens? How does he? Did everyone hear that note just coming out of nowhere? So where does it? If there's four people playing at the beginning, how does that note come out? Does anyone know? Any musicians in the audience? Yes. A fifth person to play. That's what you think, but you know, this is the magic, isn't it? And you've got four. No, it's not. This is. There's only four people on the stage. Okay, I'll play again. See if you can get it this time. Okay. So there's the melody, and there's three parts underneath it. So there's a four quartet. So how does someone play that top note? It isn't a miracle, by the way. It's just. It's wondrous that he does it. This is his first quartet. So this has got a full quartet, four parts. Who's playing that note? Yeah, I'll tell you, I just love it. This is Mozart, 14, his first quartet. So what he does is he has the viola play two parts, right? The beginning of the thing, right? So it sounds like you have got four-part harmony, but the viola's playing double stops, right? So it's playing the second violin part, and that frees the second violin to play that descant at the end. But what a genius idea, you know, it's your first quartet as a 14-year-old. You make everyone think you've got the whole quartet, and then you bring that. I'll just play the beginning one more time. And you can now you know what he's doing. Now you know his little conceit. What a way to begin your first quartet. Here we go. So it's the viola is playing two parts. And then the second violin comes above the first violin. Beautiful, right. Okay, so, beloved by God. Okay, lover of God, Mozart's Christian faith. Okay, Mozart was beloved by God. He was given this extraordinary gift of music. But was he also a lover of God? Some have read the Freemasonry Association late in his life and his apparently Masonic opera, The Magic Flute, as evidence of his own skepticism towards, or even his renunciation of, Catholicism. However, a bit of history for you now. The papal ban on Freemasonry, promulgated in Rome in 1738, was not yet in force in Austria, and many devout Catholics of that time became Freemasons, including Haydn, incredibly devout, Mozart's own father, Leopold, and Mozart himself chose a lodge with deep Catholic tradition. So it's not until 1884, you get a lot of people, you know, modern historians look back and say, oh, Mozart, he was skeptical, he was a Freemason, but it was not until the end of the 19th century, and almost a century after Mozart's death, that Pope Leo XIII's encyclical unequivocally condemned by automatic excommunication members of Masonic lodges, which, no, I won't make that comment. It's probably being recorded is you worry about saying things that you'll then later regret, and I've probably done the right, but I certainly won't make the comment which I was about to make, which I might well have regretted, and I'm sure you're fascinated with what comment it might have been had I made it, which I'm not going to. Thus, in Mozart's own lifetime, devout Catholic beliefs could go hand in hand with membership of a Masonic lodge. So just to get that out of the way. It's nonetheless true that in his early 20s, his father sent him letters which betray an anxiety that Mozart might have been getting a little lax, perhaps, about confession, and admonishing him that God must come first. From his hands we receive our temporal happiness, and at the same time we must think of our eternal salvation. But you might say, is the tone, that's a quote, of Leopold's letter really that surprising, given his son's age and circumstances, given he was, you know, the same age as most of you and at university? And is there any good reason to doubt the sincerity of his son's assurances in response? And I'm sure you write home to your mum and dad in exactly the same way as I'm about to quote from Mozart. He wrote back, Papa must not worry, for God is ever before my eyes. I can just imagine. I mean, I know you write emails now, but I know that in your emails and your Twitters, this is the kind of thing that you write to your parents. Papa must not worry, for God is ever before my eyes. I realize his omnipotence and I fear his anger, but I also recognize his love, his compassion, and his tenderness towards his creatures. He will never forsake his own. So if you need some inspiration for your letters back home, you know, just go to Mozart. You can get some great texts there, and I'm sure your mum and dad will be delighted. So Mozart's religious devotion is also evident from his letters written in the lead up to his marriage with Costanza in 1782. He writes, for a considerable time before we were married, we had always attended Mass and gone to confession and taken communion together, and I found that I never prayed so fervently or confessed and took communion so devoutly as by her side. Mozart's vow to compose a Mass if his engagement was successful, this was to be a C minor Mass, was typical of his Catholic piety, another example being his writing home enthusiastically from Rome on his tour about his devotions at various pilgrimage sites. Mozart's religious devotion to the Mass is evident, I think, in his celebrated Ave Verum, which he wrote for the Feast of the Corpus Christi in June 1791, just 6 months before his own death. Mozart does not express here a theology of the transubstantiation. He doesn't try to communicate through music theological concepts. Instead, he, it seems to me, seeks to express through music the very religious devotion he felt for the sacrament, or even the very compassion of God for man in coming to meet him intimately in the Eucharist. In doing so, Mozart invites us, the listeners, to be struck by this religious emotion and devotion, and by the beauty of this most central and awesome of Christian mysteries. So it's about 3 minutes, but I'll just play this and you can listen to it. It's very, very beautiful. And there's no adverts before this. Well, let's move on to that. That is not Ave Verum. Oh, there we go. Right, there we go. It's just a... Very moving, because he wrote that just 6 months before he died, age 35. I mean, that in itself, I think, is miraculous, that the what he composed in such a short period of time. Okay, so my next bit is God was singing through this little man to all the world. So the Russian composer, Tchaikovsky, loved Mozart above all other composers. And in his musical tribute to Mozart, the Mozartiana, he adapts this piece, the Ave Verum Motet, for orchestra as its central movement, which is just called prayer. For Tchaikovsky, to listen to Mozart was to be in the presence of divinity. But this was no distant deist divinity, but rather the Christ of the Gospels. So I love Tchaikovsky. I don't know whether you listen to Tchaikovsky, but I mean, it's just, I love Tchaikovsky. But this is what Tchaikovsky says. My relationship to Beethoven reminds me of what I felt in my childhood to the God Jehovah. Great veneration, but also fear. Christ, on the contrary, calls forth exclusively the feeling of love. He is God, but also man. He has suffered like ourselves. I love Mozart. This is Tchaikovsky. I love Mozart as the musical Christ. So Mozart's music and his compositional genius may strike us as God-given, as revealing, enabling us to participate in the beauty of God. But there appears, it seems to me, to be a real element of truth in Tchaikovsky's remark that Mozart is the musical Christ. In other words, that his music appears to pour out Christ's love into the world. Moreover, we may come to believe that Mozart's music could not have been composed in the absence of the faith that nurtured it, in the absence of the love and grace of God. And this seems to me to be one of the implications of a scene of Peter Schaffer's infamous film, Amadeus. Have any of you seen the film Amadeus? But a few, you see, I just realized, this is when I realized I really am just getting old and past it, and worms are going to be eating my body quite soon, because, you know, the sort of things that I think, well, people have seen this, but they haven't. And I just realized, I always thought that that would happen to other people, but it happened to me. And I just, you know, there's not long left. You know, youth, make the most of it, because I thought, you know, I had years ahead of me, and then suddenly you're looking behind, there's more behind than there is ahead of you. And then it's just the grave and death. Anyway, we'll come on to that. But I'll explain now. Peter Schaffer has this film, Amadeus, and it's first a play, then it's a film, and it's a fictionalized account of the relationship between Mozart and Salieri, another court composer, which, however unfair to their historical counterparts, explores a mysterious reality. Right? How is it that God may choose for his instrument a boastful, lustful, smutty, infantile boy, rather than an outwardly chaste and pious man? You scorn my attempts at virtue, Salieri rages against God. Salieri, in this scene we're about to watch, is listening to the final act of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, in which the Count asks his wife for forgiveness in the face of his manifest infidelity. I won't ask how many of you have seen The Marriage of Figaro, because it'll probably be even less than the film's Salieri, but essentially the Countess has been forced into the indignity of being wooed by her husband, the Count, while pretending to be a maid, someone else. Salieri comments, I heard the music of true forgiveness filling the theatre, conferring on all who sat there a perfect absolution. God was singing through this little man to all the world. So I'll just play this little episode from the film. Right, okay, there we go. Actually, that's not very good for my talk, this next bit. So we'll skip that, because then he says the miracle is that the emperor yawns, and then the Mozart opera is a flop. But anyway, the point I was trying to make is that actually this film does capture something that when we hear that music, or at least for me, when I hear that music, there is an emotion there which is being conveyed, which I couldn't conceive of out of the Christian faith which created it. There's something about the compassion, the forgiveness, the music, which is intrinsically linked to that. That's the point that I'm trying to make. But even faced with a miracle, whether it be Christ's first miracle of turning water into wine for the apostles, the miracles of the saints, or even for Leopold Mozart, the miracle of his son Amadeus's music, we as humans remain free to be moved or to remain unmoved. We can see God's grace at work in our world and in our humanity, but we can also reject the God who loves the world and loves us, and we can reject God's grace. And this, it seems to me, this is the profound drama, the drama of faith at the heart of Lorenzo da Ponte's retelling of the story of Don Juan and Mozart's extraordinary opera, Don Giovanni. Again, we're getting a bit of opera in today. So this opera may be performed as simply a trivial tale of unbridled sexual license and its punishment. The Libertine Punished was the original title. But beyond this sensual materialism, sex, food, wealth in abundance, lies, in my view, a deeper drama. Da Ponte and Mozart dramatize in this opera, Don Giovanni, the eruption of the supernatural, and this is what they do, the eruption of the supernatural, a miracle, into Don Giovanni's worldly material. So Don Giovanni is like Don Juan, right? He is materialist, Epicurean, atheist, right? But they dramatize the eruption of the supernatural into Don Giovanni's worldly materialism and skepticism. And his stubborn, or for atheists perhaps quixotically heroic, resistance to the grace and mercy of God. This is my last example. So the drama comes to its height in the finale of the opera's second act. Don Giovanni is enjoying a great feast when a terrifying knock is heard at the door. It is the statue of the Commendatore, the father of one of the many women Don Giovanni had raped and whose grave Don Giovanni had mocked. Coming back from the dead as promised, the Commendatore, despite Don Giovanni's extravagant sins, nonetheless offers him one last chance at repentance, inviting him to dine with him in heaven. Don Giovanni first responds with incredulity, "Non l'avrei mai creduto," I would never have believed it. But then, despite the presence of this visible miracle, and that's the point, and despite his servant's awareness that, "My Lord, we're all dead," he holds to his impenitent resolve, his impenitent resistance to God and to God's grace to the end, and in doing so, damns himself for eternity. So I'd love to play you the whole of this. I'm just going to play you the very beginning because time's moving on, but you can get it on YouTube like so many these days, and it's probably, well, look, I won't say that either because we're being recorded. Right, okay. So Don Giovanni's having his supper, he's ridiculed the statue, and then the statue comes to life, and it calls him from the dead. So he's literally saying, "A cena teco," you know, to dinner with you. Mi invitasti, you invited me to dinner. And then I've come from the dead, because he sarcastically invited him, the statue. And here's Don Giovanni. So he's seeing a miracle because the statue's come back to life. Non l'avrei mai creduto, I would never have believed it. But immediately, I'll do. But then he just says, "Leporello," to his servant, "Make another seat, another plate for the," and this is "our padron." We're all dead. And then he says, you don't eat of mortal food. Who eats in heaven? Anyway, and it goes on. It's amazing. It's amazing. But look, I'll stop just because I think we have to, we're running out of time. Is that right? Yeah. Okay. So conclusion. So I began by reflecting on Ratzinger's comment that there are three origins or founts of music. The experience of being seized by love in all cultures where you have love, whether it's with a guitar or whether it's with a flute or whatever it is, people start making music. The experience of sadness, whenever there's death and suffering, cultures spontaneously burst into song. And the experience of, or the encounter with the divine. Again, in all cultures, there is music in religious services. However, our own culture, also in its listening habits, its performance habits, might seek to bracket out the realities of death and suffering, so often hidden from view. The mystery of love, so commonly trivialized, and the reality of God, so blithely and ignorantly denied. The post-war zeitgeist of our conservatories and universities is that music's complete in itself, that anything else is extraneous, irrelevant. And under such like influences, Mozart's music, but also music as a whole, can become just another cultural commodity, the concert hall and museum of well-worn and well-known pieces, and the listener a mere seeker of aesthetic pleasure. The problem is, you know, you get to the conclusion, you end up becoming even more polemical than you have at the beginning. So I apologize if I'm preaching at this point. I don't mean to be. So in the face of secular, atheist, formalist ideologies and approaches, we may need today, therefore, to be highly intentional in reclaiming the world of the arts, in defending and appreciating art as an icon and not an idol, and in learning again to rediscover in the great spiritual patrimony of Christian art a true pathway of beauty. In refinding this pathway to God, we need not be concerned that for some it may be appreciated narrowly as a refined pleasure. After all, while the Bible is for Christians the transformative word of God which pierces the heart and invites conversion, for others, it's merely a human construct, a part, albeit a significant part, of world literature. What we must resist, I think, is giving up on beauty, giving up on art, or giving art over to the secular world, or allowing the secular frame to restrict our own experience of art's beauty and its capacity to draw us into closer and more intimate union with God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.